Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Imagine, just for a moment, getting that genetic test result back. You know, you've been waiting, maybe feeling pretty anxious about what it might say. You finally open it, you're scanning down, looking for answers, and then you see it. Variant of uncertain significance. Ah, and it's for a gene strongly linked to hereditary cancer. So it's not really a yes. Definitely not a no. It's just this huge, like, medical question mark hanging right over your health. How do you even begin to live with that kind of ambiguity? What does it actually mean for, you know, your health decisions down the line, for your family, just your peace of mind?
That scenario, it's incredibly vivid. And it's not just a thought experiment. It's a really critical everyday challenge for so many people and their doctors. It just highlights this profound need for incredibly precise interpretation of genetic variants, especially when we're talking about genes linked to serious conditions like these hereditary cancers. Because if we misinterpret a variant or we just can't interpret it definitively, it's not just, you know, a lab issue. It can have massive life-altering consequences. Think about surveillance strategies, risk reduction measures, even really personal family planning choices. This is way beyond just lab results. It's about delivering life-changing information with the highest possible confidence.
Yeah, that confidence is just everything, isn't it, when the stakes are that high? So today we're going to dive deep into a really remarkable step forward in this whole area. We're celebrating the groundbreaking work of a dedicated team, an international team of experts. It's the Hereditary Breast, Ovarian, and Pancreatic Cancer Variant Curation Expert Panel. Bit of a mouthful, so let's call it the HBOP. VCEP. They were led by researchers like Marcy E. Richardson and Fergus J. Couch. And their work together has really pushed our understanding and how we apply these interpretation guidelines for a super critical gene in cancer risk, PLB2.
Okay, so maybe let's unpack that a bit. For anyone who's, you know, looked into genetic testing, the guidelines from the American College of Medical Genetics and Genomics and the Association for Molecular Pathology, the ACMG-JP guidelines, they're kind of the foundational rule book, right?
That's exactly right. They're the bedrock for interpreting these germline variants, the ones linked to Mendelian disorders. They give us a standardized framework, which is honestly absolutely crucial for clarity in what can be a really complex field. But like any rule book, maybe it doesn't cover every single specific situation.
Precisely. The challenge is that every gene and every disease associated with it has its own unique biological quirks, its subtleties. Think of it like, I don't know, having a universal rule book for sports, but then realizing that, well, baseball needs different specifics than, say, basketball. For a gene like PLB2, these nuances are incredibly important. So PLB2 itself, it's a tumor suppressor gene. It sits on chromosome 16p12.2 and is a really vital player in this cellular repair crew, the homologous recombination repair pathway.
Okay, a repair crew for our DNA.
Yeah, basically. It's our body's sophisticated system for fixing really serious DNA damage, like double-strand breaks, keeping our genome stable. When this system, this repair pathway is faulty, well, things can go pretty wrong.
So if this repair system is vital, what happens when PLB2 specifically is compromised?
Right. So if you inherit just one altered copy of PLB2, meaning, you know, one of your two copies isn't working right, that's linked to a significantly higher lifetime risk of hereditary breast cancer, ovarian cancer, and pancreatic cancer. The cell loses some repairability, but can often still cope, sort of. But there's another layer here. If someone inherits two altered copies, one from each parent, these are called biallelic variants. And that causes something totally different and much more severe, Fanconi anemia subtype N.
Fanconi anemia, that sounds serious.
It is. It's a rare, devastating childhood condition. You see growth problems, severe birth defects, and sadly, very early onset childhood cancers. In that case, the whole DNA repair system is critically broken, leading to these profound developmental problems.
Wow. Okay, so it's clear that getting the interpretation right for PLB2 variants isn't, you know, just some academic thing. It directly affects whether you get access to life-saving screening, maybe risk-reducing surgeries, or making those really tough family planning decisions. It's about getting real, actionable answers for people. And that's exactly where this HBOP VCEP comes in, right? To bring that clarity.
Exactly. This HBOP VCEP is really a powerhouse of expertise. You've got 23 members from 7 different countries, and they cover the whole spectrum: basic science, variant interpretation, tumor pathology, clinical genetics, genetic counseling, you name it. They got together back in 2018 with a really clear mission:
to find these super specific gene-tailored guidelines for a whole panel of important genes. They'd already done ATM, and PALB2 was next on their list. This kind of international cross-discipline approach is just key.
And their process sounds like it was incredibly thorough, not just a quick look.
Oh, absolutely rigorous. They met regularly, went through each one of the 28 codes from those original 2015 ACMGMCM guidelines with the fine-tooth comb. They were constantly asking, okay, how relevant is this code for PALB2 specifically? Do we need to limit how it's used, tailor it to fit PALB2's biology? Or, you know, maybe just say, nope, this one doesn't apply here at all.
So they started with the literature, their own data.
That's right. Literature reviews, internal data, and critically, their collective expert opinion. That's invaluable. But they didn't just write the rules and stop. They did this crucial pilot phase. They actually tested these draft rules on 39 different PALB2 variants, a real mix, frameshift, nonsense, missense, splicing variants, the works.
So like a real-world stress test.
Exactly. And it wasn't just one person. Variants were curated independently by two trained biocurators. Then they compared how they applied the codes, checked for agreement concordance, and harmonized everything in this tool called the variant curation interface. This step was absolutely vital for ironing out any kinks, catching ambiguities before they could cause problems in the clinic.
And then, after all that testing and refining, it went for official review.
Yep. The proposed PALB2 specific guidelines went to the Sequence Variant Interpretation Group, the SVI group, for formal review. They got final tweaks and were officially approved on March 17th, 2023. And what's really significant here, this whole process is actually FDA recognized. It's a benchmark for quality, highly respected. It ensures the final guidelines are robust, reliable, and ready for clinical use worldwide.
Okay, so let's get into the nitty-gritty. What were some of the key changes they made? You said they streamlined things a lot.
They really did. It was a major overhaul, moving from that general ACMGM framework to something tuned specifically for PALB2. A big piece was realizing that 13 of the original codes were just not applicable, period, for PALB2. Another 6 codes were limited. You could only use them in very specific circumstances. And 9 others were actively tailored to fit PALB2's biology.
13 codes just thrown out for PALB2. Wow. Why? What kinds of codes were those?
Well, a key example is codes that rely heavily on the patient's phenotype, their clinical picture. Things like PS4, which involves counting affected family members, or PP4, other phenotype evidence. These were deemed not applicable for the main way PALB2 causes cancer risk, which is autosomal dominant inheritance. And the reason is pretty straightforward, actually. Breast, ovarian, pancreatic cancers. Unfortunately, they're relatively common in the general population anyway.
Right. Lots of cases are sporadic, not inherited.
Exactly. And crucially, we don't really have specific biomarkers or clinical features that let us confidently say, this cancer is definitely due to the PALB2 variant, not just sporadic chance.
Mm.
So you can't reliably use the presence of these common cancers in a family as strong proof that a specific PALB2 variant is pathogenic. It's just not specific enough evidence.
Okay, that makes sense. And you mentioned something earlier that sounded really interesting, their approach to missense variants, those single letter changes.
Yes, missense variants, always the tricky ones. The VCEP took a very, very conservative stance here. Codes that relate to, say, finding the same amino acid change as the known pathogenic variant, that's PS1, or variants in a mutational hotspot, PM1, or changing an amino acid where a different change was already known to be pathogenic, PM5, these were mostly not used or were severely limited for PALB2 missense variants.
Why so cautious with those? It seems like that kind of evidence would be useful.
It seems like it should be, but here's the problem. Currently, the evidence that missense changes are a major established way PALB2 causes disease just isn't firmly there yet, clinically speaking. We have lab studies, sure, functional assays showing what a variant might do to the protein in a dish, but translating that reliably to actual disease risk in humans and benchmarking those lab results. That link is still largely missing for PALB2 missense variants. It really highlights a huge challenge across the field. We desperately need better, high-throughput functional data that we know correlates well with clinical outcomes for these types of variants. Without that solid data, caution is absolutely the right, responsible approach.
Got it. So they were cautious where the evidence is still developing. What about areas where the evidence is strong? What codes did they really lean on or refine?
Right, exactly. Now we get to where the picture is much clearer. Loss-of-function variants, Lackey-Vanning variants, the ones that basically break the gene, stop the protein from being made properly, or truncate it. These are the well-understood, primary way PALB2 causes disease. And these variants get the very strongest evidence code for pathogenicity, PVS1.
PVS1, pathogenic very strong one.
Precisely. And the VCEP didn't just say use PVS1, they gave incredibly detailed, specific guidance on how and when to apply it. They looked at things like the exact start position of the gene, whether natural variations in splicing could potentially rescue a bad variant, spoiler. They found it doesn't for PALB2. They mapped out the critical functional domains, like the WD40 domain. Absolutely essential. Any variant messing that up gets strong pathogenic evidence. They even defined a specific point near the end of the protein, HIS-1184. Any variant that cuts the protein off before that point, boom, PVS1. This level of detail, mapping the gene's anatomy, it removes so much guesswork for the labs.
That is incredibly specific.
It is. And they even distinguish between predicting a splicing problem based on the DNA code versus actually seeing it happen in RNA experiments. The observed RNA evidence gets even stronger weight, as you'd expect.
And I think you mentioned population data too, making sure these variants are actually rare.
Yes, absolutely. Codes like BA1, benign standalone,
right,
and BS1, benign strong. These are used to filter out variants that are just too common in the population to be causing a rare hereditary condition. They use a sophisticated statistical method, that Whiffenware equation, which considers things like how common breast cancer is and how much PLB2 contributes to that risk. This let them calculate very conservative frequency thresholds. If a variant shows up in more than 0.1% of people, BA1, it's likely benign. If it's above 0.01%, BS1, that's strong evidence it's benign. It's like setting the very fine filter to make sure we only focus on truly rare variants as potential culprits. They also carefully defined how to use PM2, another code related to rarity.
Okay, so they've done all this incredibly detailed work, refining codes, setting specific thresholds. What was the actual impact? Did it help with those uncertain variants?
It really did. The pilot study showed clear improvements. So out of those 39 variants they tested, their new PLB2 specific rules agreed with the existing classifications in the ClinVar database about 84% of the time. That's pretty good concordance. But here's the really crucial part. Remember those tricky variants. The ones listed in ClinVar as variant of uncertain significance, VUS, or where different labs disagreed. Out of 14 such ambiguous variants in their pilot set, the VCEP was able to resolve to definitively reclassify 4 of them.
4 out of 14 moved out of uncertainty.
Exactly. Reclassified as either benign, likely benign, pathogenic, or likely pathogenic. Now, 4 out of 14 might sound small, but it represents a 5% increase in certainty just within that tricky subset. And for the individuals carrying those specific variants, that 5% isn't just a statistic. It's the difference between maybe years of anxiety and having a clear answer to guide their healthcare. That's huge.
That really puts it into perspective. It sounds like these guidelines are, well, both conservative where needed, but also more effective at actually resolving uncertainty. Which seems a bit paradoxical.
I mean, it does seem that way, doesn't it? They were more conservative in some ways, for instance. They actually reclassified 2 variants that were considered likely pathogenic or pathogenic in ClinVar back down to VUS because the evidence just didn't meet their stricter PALB2 specific criteria.
Mm-hmm.
But that conservatism is precisely what makes them more effective overall.
How so?
Well, it comes back to those 2 main challenges we talked about. One, the commonness of the cancers involved makes it hard to rely solely on family history or phenotype sometimes. And 2, the big one, the ongoing difficulty in really nailing down the clinical impact of missense variants for PALB2. Pathogenic missense variants probably exist, but they seem to be extremely rare and hard to validate clinically. I mean, think about this. 90% of all the PALB2 VUS results currently logged in ClinVar are missense variants.
90%. That just highlights the scale of the missense challenge.
It absolutely does. So the VCEP's careful, sometimes conservative approach is about ensuring we don't overcall pathogenicity based on weaker evidence types, especially for missense changes. It prevents potentially harmful misdirection in clinical care while still being powerful enough with rules like the refined PVS1 to resolve uncertainty where the evidence is strong, like for those LEVF variants.
Okay, so it's a major step forward, but clearly the work isn't, you know, finished. This isn't the final word forever.
Oh, absolutely not. Science doesn't stand still. The VCEP fully anticipates that new data will keep emerging, especially, hopefully, that much-needed high-throughput functional data for all those missense variants. That could be a game-changer. They're committed to regularly reviewing new evidence, updating these specifications as needed, and working to ensure that PLB2 variant interpretations stay harmonized and consistent in public databases like ClinVar.
So it's an ongoing process.
It has to be. It's a continuous effort to enhance clinical practice for hereditary cancer. The goal is always clearer, more consistent, more confident answers for you, the patient, and for the clinicians guiding your care.
This whole process ensures that the rulebook for PLB2 keeps evolving right alongside our scientific understanding. At the end of the day, the HPOP VCEP's tailored PLB2 guidelines really show the power of bringing focused, gene-specific expertise to the table. It's a fantastic example of how deep scientific collaboration leads directly to more accurate, more harmonized classifications for really critical conditions like hereditary cancer risk and Fanconi anemia.
And that enhanced precision, even with its careful, conservative approach where needed, it directly improves the clinical usefulness of genetic testing for you, the listener. It helps turn that potentially terrifying variant of uncertain significance into something much more concrete, something that can actually guide health decisions with more confidence. What does this really mean for the bigger picture of personalized medicine? A future where maybe every single base pair counts towards truly understanding your individual health risks and guiding those critical life decisions. It feels like we're moving, step by careful step, closer to a world where a genetic finding is less about a question mark and much more about a clear path forward. This deep dive was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.